This is Wisconsin Public Radio, and this is where Western Wisconsin shows off the arts and culture we find around every corner and every nook and cranny of our distinguished landscape. It's where the people and places tell their story and become friends. I'm Al Ross. This week, we're going to talk about something very evident in the culture of 2017, the creation and distribution of what's called fake news. It's not a new concept, but the vehicles by which it navigates and the voices using the term to indict others are. UW River Falls will discuss it, and we have instructors in political science and journalism to examine and preview. We'll look ahead to Saturday's 8th Annual Fiber Arts and, new this year, Folklife Festival. Jim Oliver lists theater productions on West Wisconsin stages and then turns the spotlight on one in rehearsal from the Menominee Theater Guild. And here's the point from which this information vessel sails this week. Right now, Jenna Burcheski is in South Korea with four teammates and her coach. And if you're listening on Thursday, today they're competing in their first game. Although Korea is 15 hours ahead of us, so it's early Friday morning there. Anyway, they're at the World Junior Curling Championships. Jenna grew up in Massachusetts. Her hometown is just outside Boston. She's in her second year at UW Eau Claire, so she's an adopted family member. And she's been involved in the sport of curling for many years already. We caught up with her somewhere between trying to fit everything into her luggage and heading for the airport. Since age 5, you've been curling.
It's definitely a compiled amount of memories younger with my dad having me out on the ice. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure you can even really call it curling, but I was sitting on the ice and I was pushing the rocks.
Did he introduce you to it?
Yeah, so I'm a third generation curler.
Oh, yep. That's cool. So you have pressure on you.
Oh, for sure. My grandfather started curling.
Wow.
And then he got my dad into it, and my dad has since gotten myself and my two brothers into it. And I also have a niece, actually, who has started curling.
Were you hooked right away? Do you remember being hooked on curling? Is that something you just couldn't wait to do again and again and again?
I actually was not. Oddly enough, I started curling when I was really young, and I quit for a while. I did not like it when my parents dragged me to the curling club on Sundays and all my friends were out having fun and I had to go curling. But eventually I picked it back up probably around fourth grade, maybe fifth.
But why did you have to go?
You know, it's kind of like any other sport that a parent would sign their kid up for.
Oh, sure.
Soccer or, yes. You know, if you did Girl Scouts.
You're going to follow through on this.
Yeah, exactly.
Did like your high school have a team?
Unfortunately, out in the East Coast, we don't really have as many curlers as they do in the Midwest. Ah. But with a lack of curlers at my high school, it pushed me out into the world a little bit more. Most mm-hmm. of my teammates were from other states.
So when did you realize you had a future in this sport, that you were kind of good?
Somewhere in the high school area, my team started doing playdowns when I was really young.
What's a playdown?
That's a competition for each region. If you win the playdown, you qualify for nationals. So as I got older, we slowly started placing higher and higher at the playdown until eventually we qualified for nationals. I've been there 4 years now. Collected all three medals and a sixth place finish. Since then, I've really just been going all for it.
What brought you to Eau Claire? Why UW Eau Claire?
Well, I definitely came to the Midwest for curling.
Okay.
Yeah, cool. It was really necessary for me to be out here. This is where all the top curlers are, whether they were born out here or moved out here.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, that's around Blaine, Minnesota. But I was touring colleges out here, and mm-hmm. I came to Eau Claire with my mom, and I looked at the school, and I told her, I was like, I don't need to see the other ones. This is
really?
It.
Really? Wow.
I knew. Yep.
That's pretty neat. Blaine is an Olympic training area.
There's, yes, it is.
There's like a track there. So is it for curling, too?
Yep. It's the Olympic training site for curling. It was officially named a few years ago.
Does UW Eau Claire have a curling team?
We do. We recently restarted the program. It was originally started by a professor at Eau Claire named Bob Scott, and it lied dormant for a few years until one of my really good friends, Allison Weidenbeck, she really took the reins on it. I've kind of been helping her along as much as I can, but yeah, mm-hmm. recently we've restarted the program.
We're in the studio with Jenna Burcheski, and she is from Massachusetts, but she's a sophomore at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. She's headed to South Korea for the World Junior Curling Championships. It begins on the 16th. It's a 10-day deal.
Oh, yeah.
It's 16th to 26th. That's quite a while to be curling, isn't it?
It's a very long competition. Since it's an Olympic year, they've extended the amount of time that we're there. Normally, the worlds don't go this long, but we are actually the trial run for the 2018 Olympics.
Ooh.
So we'll be competing in Pyeongchang in the Olympic venue, and
that's
who we're going to be for the whole 2 weeks.
And this is the junior championships. When do you get to not be a junior anymore?
So juniors consist of ages 21 and under. You know, it ranges. You will have girls there who are probably 16 years old, and then you're going to have other girls there who are 21.
10 teams are going to be there, I read. I was on the website. Canada, Hungary, Japan, Korea, Russia, Scotland, Switzerland, Sweden, Turkey, and the good old U.S. It's a round-robin tournament. You got to play everybody?
Yep. So we'll play every country that's coming, and then from there, hopefully we'll make it to the playoffs and be able to keep going and bring home a medal for the U.S.
Yes, USA, USA. In the tournament, you play Turkey first, I saw on the schedule. Are there things you know about an opponent? Are there strategies that you devise for certain opponents?
For the most part, when you compete within the country, you get to know the other curlers that you're playing against. And for our team, the same thing applies for when we go up to Canada. We play a lot of the same teams. So you kind of come to know how they play and you develop a strategy to play against each team. Going into this competition, we really do not know any of the other teams. So we're kind of heading in blind to this. We're just going to play our game and hopefully pull out some wins.
Are there both offensive and defensive strategies in curling?
Absolutely. There's games when you're up on the scoreboard and all you're doing is just making sure that the other team doesn't score. And there's games when you're down on the scoreboard and you're just scratching to get every point that you can.
I see the lineup and you're listed as a second. What does a second mean?
So if I was relating it to another sport, second would be like playing a defensive position. I am trying to make sure that the other team doesn't score. It means that I throw the third and fourth rocks of the game and
okay.
I sweep for the other three players.
People on the team are a fourth, a third. Well, there's a skip and a vice, I see in parentheses. A fourth, third, second, and a lead. And there's an alternate. Is the alternate just a sub that comes off the bench?
Yeah, when you go to the World Championships, you're required to take an alternate.
Okay.
Just in case something happens to a member. You know, if somebody gets hurt, you need to have someone else who's ready to jump off the bench and into the game. We were very fortunate that Madison Bear from Portage, Wisconsin, was willing to take that position and travel to Korea with us.
I saw that name, Madison Bear, and I thought, is that like a mascot? But it's actually a girl.
Yep, that's her name.
It's a girl's name. So you brought up the word injuries.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of injuries do curlers get?
There are many ways to injure yourself on and off the ice. I mean, I've known curlers who have injured themselves just stretching, getting onto the ice. I define that as being clumsy, but there's definitely ways to get injured on the ice. I myself have fallen a few times and, you know, injured a wrist before. Sometimes, you know, you do that and you're able to pull through and keep playing the game. And there are other times when it's just better to bring in somebody fresh and who can, you know, compete at their full potential.
You brought up the word stretch. How does a curler warm up?
You warm up just like any other sport. For the most part, you want to do dynamic warm-ups, not static. You're mainly just stretching out your arms and legs, just trying to get yourself pumped up for the game, same as any other sport would.
How about equipment? Is all the equipment supplied wherever you go, or are you like a bowler? You carry your own stones with you, or what happens?
So as far as equipment goes, the only thing that's supplied is the rocks. When you get to the arena, they'll have the rocks already there. And as far as other equipment, we have special shoes.
I've seen those.
Yeah. Common thought is that we use skates. That is not true. They're regular shoes. You can even get them custom made with sneakers. And they have a Teflon slider on the bottom of one foot. So that makes the ice extremely slippery.
Yes.
So everyone has their own pair, and you travel with those, as well as your broom, which I'm sure you've seen before is the sweeping portion of it.
Yeah.
And then
kind of a stiff, like a scrubbing brush.
Yeah, exactly. Its primary function is to break down the pebble on the ice, which will make the stone travel further and straighter.
Do you wear the same shoes as a sweeper as you do as a server or whatever you call it?
Yep. So you'll wear the same shoes. Some people will sweep with the slider still on the shoe. Other people will put a cap over it called a gripper. They just become like regular street shoes. They'll grip the ice a little bit better.
Yeah, because when you said it makes the ice very slippery, I thought, well, why would you want to go running down the ice sweeping with something really slippery on your shoe?
Yeah.
What is practice like? Repetition?
Yeah, a lot of repetition. There's a lot of muscle memory involved in curling. When we practice as a team. We'll go through things like team shots. We'll have somebody analyze our deliveries, which is the slide, to see if there's anything that we're doing, you know, whether we have a slight inconsistency or if there's just one little thing that's off that can really throw off the entire shot.
Tell us about your coach, Bev.
She's from Stevens Point, Wisconsin.
Gosh, look at all these Wisconsin. Are there others other than Madison and you?
Yeah, Anne-Marie actually is from Portage, Wisconsin.
She has a German name.
Yes, she does. So she's from Portage, Wisconsin, as well as Madison.
So Portage must be like a hotbed for curling, huh?
You know what? It is. There's a lot of curlers out of Portage, and I know in the past years they've been winning their high school championships. Definitely a lot of good players come out of there.
And Christine is from where?
Christine is originally from Maryland, She now lives in White Bear Lake, Minnesota.
You teamed up with all these people having competed in other things, and a coach looks at you and says, we got to have Jenna on our team.
Previously, Allison and I have played together in 4 national championships. We've also played with Christine in our very first national championship. And then the following year, which was our second one, Allison and I played with Madison and Anne-Marie.
Mm.
We've, except for Allison and I, we've been split up and put back together. This past year, we've all been accepted to the High Performance Program, which is a program designed to make the sport of curling a little bit more professional. They hold a combine every year, and you have to be invited to the combine. There, they'll test you on your on-ice skills, your physical strength. They do strategy tests, mental kind of tests. And from there, the 4 of us were selected to be put on a team together. And Madison was actually put on a separate team from the rest of us.
Oh, okay.
And her team won the silver medal at the U.S. Junior National Championships, and we took her on as our alternate.
So it does help to be familiar with other teammates. Going back to my interview last year, I do know, having watched some video of people curling, it does get kind of vocal.
Yes.
It would feel weird to yell at somebody who you don't know very well.
You know, if you play curling for long enough, it sort of just becomes a normal thing. That
the skip is the one that yells.
Yeah.
Says you got to sweep more or sweep less. Or
yeah.
Okay, there you go.
So it really does just become a normal thing. You kind of just get used to it. But as far as knowing each other really well, it definitely helps to have strong team dynamics, especially being on a team that only has 5 people, unlike bigger sports like soccer and stuff where you have like 20-some kids on a team. You got to know your teammates.
How do you think you're going to do? How do you stack up? Is there a powerhouse or are you guys the powerhouse?
I'm not sure there really is a powerhouse going into this competition. Team Canada has always dominated on the world stage in every event. But this year, the 4 girls going are completely brand new. They've never been to the Worlds before. Their alternate has. She's returning from last year. And I think we stand a good shot. You know, we're really hoping to go for a medal this year. We'd like to make the playoffs and bring home a medal for the U.S.
This will air on the first day of competition, and you will still be competing the following Thursday. So on the 23rd, I will be able to say, hey, guess how Jenna and her gang are doing? The website's pretty cool. I'll be able to see how everybody's doing. There's also a junior men's team going.
Yes, there is. And we're really good friends with them, and we're going to be supporting each other throughout the week.
All I can say is good luck.
Thank you.
I mean, I don't think you need it. You'll represent us well. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Jenna Burcheski, a UW Eau Claire student on the women's junior team representing America. She mentioned a website that's kind of like the ESPN of curling. It's curlingzone.com. We'll probably be able to follow the action there. Their first game of the tournament, of course, today, or probably finished already. We'll try to get a score for you on that. This is Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota, offering the all-wheel drive Highlander, an SUV committed to reliability. Marquardt Toyota is located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, or at marquardttoyota.com. Support also comes from DeNovo Med Spa in Eau Claire, offering aesthetic treatments and preventative skin care with personalized service to address every chapter of life. More details are at DeNovoMedSpa.com. Well, with a knack for uncovering and expounding on some of Western Wisconsin's best-kept secrets as life relates to the theater and those who bring it to us, Here's Jim Oliver.
The Secret Garden is a musical based on the 1911 novel of the same name by Frances Hodgson Burnett. The musical's script and lyrics are by Marsha Norman with music by Lucy Simon. It premiered in New York in 1991 and ran for 709 performances. The Menominee Theater Guild production of The Secret Garden will be performed at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts February 24th, 25th, 26th, and March 3rd, 4th, and 5th. In the studio to talk about The Secret Garden are the director, Leslie Norris, and Latasha Greeley, who portrays Lily in the production. So, Leslie, what is The Secret Garden?
The Secret Garden is a garden that was locked away after the death of Lily, who is the mother of Colin and wife of Archibald Craven. Lily was a passionate gardener, and it was her joy and Archie's joy to let her have this beautiful walled garden. However, she fell from a limb of a tree while she was pregnant, gave premature birth to Colin, and died right after he was born. Archie's grief was such that he never wanted to step into the garden or have anyone else ever be in the garden again. So the garden was locked up and left to go very, very dormant for 10 years.
So somebody finds it? Is that the idea?
Yes. Mary is told about the garden and wants to get into the garden. It is locked, and during the course of the show, she finds the key to the garden, is able to locate the door and go into the garden. And the garden is life to both Mary and Colin and Archie, and it is all about the power of love and nature to heal, to transform, and to offer renewal.
Now, there's a lot of music in the show. It is a big cast. Talk about the music.
The music is absolutely gorgeous. The show itself is almost 75% music. Mm-hmm. We have an extraordinary cast that has tackled this very complex music and is doing a wonderful job. Lucy Simon and Marsha Norman wrote music that will just soar in the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts.
Mm-hmm. Latasha, tell us about this character of Lily that you play.
Yes, Lily is extremely graceful, although she is dead, and that's how the show starts. I've never played a ghost before, but she has so much life to her. She's filled with love and hope. It just is an honor to play her, and I continue to learn more about Lily and evolve her. And really, she doesn't feel like a ghost because she's there, and she's everywhere with Archie, trying to help him move on and move forward. It's really great. She's extremely beautiful.
Now, a lot of ghost characters, they talk back and forth to the live characters. Do you talk back and forth, and can the live characters hear you?
No. The only time that I have spoken words are flashbacks. I am really a presence. I can be felt and heard. I sing, but I do not interact or speak with my husband or my son or the audience.
And actually, half of the cast are people who died of the cholera, dreamers, and their spirits have followed Mary over from India to Yorkshire to help her get a life back. And so they are omnipresent as well.
Is there a pretty elaborate set?
There's a lovely set, but it is more representational rather than literal. That's one of the exciting things about this show for me as a director. My husband is our technical director and set designer and has created a set for us to work with where once the curtain opens, it doesn't stop until intermission. So the actors who are the dreamers are actually moving, changing the set pieces to represent different rooms, the greenhouse, the garden, the moor. It's kind of like a dance. There is motion and beauty and music just kind of from start to finish.
We are talking to Leslie Norris, who is director of the Menominee Theater Guild production of The Secret Garden. With her is Latasha Greeley, who is playing the character of Lily in the show. What about the technical people, the musical director, choreographer, the orchestra?
We have a phenomenal production team that is just amazing. As I said, my husband, Jim Miller, is our technical director. My musical director, Tom Fluke, Tom is an extraordinarily talented musician and conductor. He grew up in Menominee and then moved to the Twin Cities for many decades, very active in musical theater, conducting, teaching, giving voice lessons, piano lessons, and just about 2 years ago moved back to the area, and we are so glad he did. He has an amazing gift of getting people to believe in themselves and moving them musically forward in ways that they never thought they could do. And he does it with kindness and with wit and patience. So he's extraordinary, as are the rest of our crew. Astonishing costumer, Sue King, taught costuming and historical costuming, retired, and again, the Guild is really fortunate to have her. She's been making beautiful, beautiful vintage costumes, using several vintage costumes that she puts together in brand new ways that are also very accurate to the 1906 time period of the novel. Just extraordinary. We also have Mark Mastalier, one of our cast members, choreographed the waltz scene for us. It was just a wonderful stroke of luck that he is able to do that, because that's really the only dance. This is not kind of the traditional musical with a lot of dance in it. It's the motion of the play. I also have a great assistant director, Nan Becker, stage manager, Emily Meals, and assistant stage manager, Belle Hurley. I couldn't imagine tackling this show without all of these people.
Well, Natasha, tell us about your background in theater.
The first show that I ever did, I was 16 years old. Kobe Shaw and Steve Renfrey gave me the fabulous role of the strawberry seller in Oliver, which Leslie was also in. So how perfect. And I've been doing musical theater ever since. It's just incredibly amazing to be involved in the Menominee Theater Guild. And then I did shows throughout high school, and it's just continued after that. And I'll almost be 32, so I've been doing it half my life.
Wow.
Yeah.
Leslie, I was reading your biography. You've been around all over the place. Do you do mostly directing, or you do acting?
I'm predominantly an actor, and this is my first big musical directing. 28 people. They are marvelous, but this is my first tackling a large musical. I grew up moving all over the place. I'm always constantly amazed that it's been 30 years now that I've lived in the Midwest, and here I am. I have done a variety of jobs. I was an actor at Fannie Hill for many, many years.
Most difficult part, I would think, about having a play with 28 characters is to figure out what you're going to do with those people backstage.
Well, that, again, is one of the exciting things about this show. There isn't a lot of time that anybody is backstage.
Oh, okay.
It's not your traditional leads and chorus. It really is an ensemble show. While there are some more principal roles, every single person is important and every single person is involved. We do have a delightful group of five children ages 9 to 12 who are our children's chorus that opens the show, and they're in the opening scene in Act Two, and they will join us in the finale as well. They will be off stage otherwise. Mm-hmm. But pretty much everyone else, there isn't a lot of time to sit around and chat.
You know, Leslie kind of talked about it. The show just continuously flows. Mm. There's always something going on, whether it's moving a set piece or preparing your next prop, or you're exiting a scene while someone else is coming on. I mean, there's constant flow and movement, which is great. It's not your typical Oklahoma musical. Love that stuff too, but the show is just so extremely powerful. Everyone is important. Everyone's character is different, and we get to play with our characters and keep adding dimensions to them. And between Leslie and Jim and Tom, there's like hundreds of years of experience that went into creating the show.
There really is. A lot of years.
Lots of talent.
Thank you, Dave.
Well, the Menominee Theater Guild production of The Secret Garden will be performed at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts February 24th, 25th, and 26th, and March 3rd, 4th, and 5th. We've been talking to the director, Leslie Norris, and Latasha Greeley, who plays Lily. For ticket information, you can use your favorite internet search engine to locate the Menominee Theater Guild. Ladies, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Oliver. Here's a Spectrum Memo, Wisconsin Arts West 38, a major juried exhibit for regional artists, opens Sunday at the L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. A reception will be held next Thursday, February 23rd, 7 o'clock. in the gallery. The library's mezzanine, the exhibit can be seen in the gallery and throughout the library through March 31st. Well, for 7 years, it was the Fiber Arts Festival, and this, the 8th year, happening Saturday. It has a new structure. The location's the same, the Chippewa Valley Museum in Eau Claire's Carson Park. And director Carrie Ronander is into her second year at the helm. She brought along a preview of this year's alterations. It's called Fiber Arts and Folklife Festival. It may be the 8th annual event, but it's actually the first annual Fiber Arts and Folklife Festival. It's an expanded event. Talk about the process of evolution that occurred between last year and this year's new format.
Well, we work with a lot of different artists and different crafts folks, mm-hmm. and we just saw that there was a new opportunity to bring different people into the museum to share their art form, mm-hmm. and we thought this would be a fun way to do it.
How soon did you decide that you were going to have a new format, and then what did you have to do to entice people to come and be part of it?
I don't think it was too hard to entice the artists to come. Our educator works with a lot of different folks throughout the year for different kinds of programming.
Okay.
And just talking to them, they wanted to participate at the museum in a different way than just in a class or a workshop. Uh-huh. And so she was the one, Karen Jacobson, who thought it might be a good idea to expand the festival. And in her discussions with the different artists, they were eager to sign on. Uh-huh. And so I think late spring was when she realized that there was an opportunity for more growth in the festival, mm-hmm. and was able to just add people to the point where we're kind of overflowing with artists. Yeah, over 40. Last year we had 31. So trying to find places to put everybody has been a bit of a challenge, a fun challenge, but it's been a challenge.
It's supposed to be a beautiful day. You could put some outside.
Almost, which is good because parking is rather limited right in front of our building.
Well, you know, folk traditions, as we have mentioned, and it, as it relates to the title, are going to be emphasized because there are several different influences that touch our lives. Now, I know there's a certain ethnicity, both present and historical, that's being injected into this one. Native American, European, and Asian. Big one around here is Scandinavian. Of course, that's part of the European. Talk about how the ethnic side of folk traditions is going to be emphasized. Did you go after people who are participating in that vein?
Yes. We talked to some folks who do rosemalin, a Norwegian art form, and we have some individuals who are coming to do a lefse making. Then you can try it right
there.
We
can eat it. Good. I was going to ask that, yeah.
I don't know that we have a German tradition brought in. We do have a Ukrainian tradition, Psanky egg. That is very fine, detailed, painted eggs.
How about Native Americans and Asians?
We have some Hmong artists doing Hmong textiles.
Okay.
And we do have Dick Mindikowski. He does Native American art, beaver shield, walking sticks, beading, trapping, all kinds of things.
Now, fiber art, because it was there first, is still a big ingredient. In fact, it too is expanding. You'll be looking at the connection to agricultural heritage and environmental stewardship, so says the release that I received.
We have a large farm exhibit in our museum, and so connecting the agricultural part of that exhibit with other artists just makes it a natural connection. So we have people demonstrating production of flax all the way to the fiber that comes from the flax. We have sheep, the wool, and the what you do with wool. So from the beginning to the end product.
You don't have real sheep.
I've heard tell that there might be real sheep there.
Ooh.
I don't know if it's definitive or not, but that's the rumor that's been going around. Not in the museum, outside the museum.
Sure. When do they shear sheep? Must be in the spring, because they have to have that thick coat for the wintertime.
That'd be a very cold winter for a sheep to have that.
Carrie Ronander is our guest. She is director, of course, of the Chippewa Valley Museum, 8th Annual Fiber Arts, and this year, and Folklife Festival is coming up this Saturday, the 18th. It's 11 to 4 at the museum. So you're going to have traditional food, music, and performance, too, also enhanced.
Yes, Doug Wozniak, he's been working with the museum for different kinds of programs. He writes his own music, guitar accompaniment, and he'll be performing in our theater, actually, at the museum.
Traditional food.
That would be the lefse.
Oh, yeah. But you have an ice cream parlor. That's a popular place. Are you enhancing what's going to be available there? You have soup and sandwiches, I think I remember from
We do have soup and sandwiches, and we have the ice cream, you know, which in some ways Wisconsin is our traditional food.
Do you know what kind of soup you're going to have?
I do not.
You don't?
No, I
no
don't.
No sandwiches? Now, see, when I was a kid, my father, every Saturday noon, made himself a Braunschweiger and onion sandwich.
Now, that's a good German one.
That might be wrong, but it seemed like every Saturday. after he had his Braunschweiger and onion sandwich, he would take my brother and I downstairs, and he would cut our hair. He would whistle, and his breath was just about the worst thing in the world with the Braunschweiger and onion. And so my brother and I have never forgotten that.
Delightful memory.
Isn't that a good story?
Of Braunschweiger.
Yes. And actually, I love Braunschweiger. Isn't that weird? I would think if this is a family affair, and it certainly is designed to be that, you would want peanut butter and jelly somewhere along the line.
I'm sure the sandwiches that we have will be quite tasty.
So now, I also noted that in the museum, there's something called Always Beating in a Postscript Gallery. Now, I'm curious about both of those things. I love the idea of a Postscript Gallery. Postscript PS, like at the end of a letter. Postscript Gallery, something that's waiting for you just before you leave. Hey, by the way, you should visit this.
That is actually what it is. It's in a hallway that connects one of our exhibits to the front of the museum. But the gallery itself is a postscript to our larger Changing Currents exhibit. Topics that we cover in the Postscript Gallery are related to what we cover in the larger exhibit. It allows us to look at more subjects over time. It's easier to change 150 square foot exhibit out compared to a 4,200 square foot exhibit.
Okay.
The exhibit we have right now in that gallery, the Postscript Gallery, is Always Beating, and it looks at beadwork and the artistry behind it of Native American beadwork, specifically Ojibwe and Ho-Chunk.
Here's your chance, because you're sitting in front of a microphone, to promote other stuff going on at the museum.
The Always Beating exhibit, actually, this is the last festival that it will be up at the museum.
Okay.
We're working on a new exhibit called Harvesting Traditions, which will open this fall, that will look at hunting, fishing, gathering traditions in our region. The next big thing the museum is doing is actually on April 1st, we're having a dance hall revival fundraiser.
Okay.
Actually, outside the museum at the Florian Gardens, and that will raise funds for our educational services and programs in the museum. It should be a lot of fun looking at the music from the 50s and 60s and 70s and dance halls in the region. You'll be able to tap our way. I guess you don't tap, but you can dance across the floor.
The stroll was big in the 50s, the dance. I think you ought to have that. You ought to have some people there who know how to do the stroll. I've always thought that was iconic. And the twist, obviously, was big in the 60s.
Arthur Murray Dance Studios will do a small demonstration, so I'm sure there'll be examples of those kinds of dances that night.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Carrie, thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
It's Saturday, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., the Chippewa Valley Museum, the Fiber Arts and Folk Life Festival. Information always available online at cvmuseum.com. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona. Collections comprised of art inspired by water from European and American masters, including Picasso, Audubon, and more. More about the museum at mmam.org. We're feeling a bit warmer temperatures, and Western Wisconsin stages and theater companies have warmed up a bit as well. He takes the pulse and the temperature. Here again is Jim Oliver.
Thanks, Al. The University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire Theater will present Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street, February 23rd to the 26th and March 2nd to the 5th in the Gantner Concert Hall, Haas Fine Arts Center at the University. The Awesome 80s Prom will be staged through Saturday and next Thursday through Saturday at the Northern Star Theater in Rice Lake. The Menominee Theater Guild will present The Secret Garden at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts February 24th, 25th, 26th, and March 3rd, 4th, and 5th. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will present Moon Over Buffalo through Sunday at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. A Tale of Two Cities, based on the novel by Charles Dickens, will be staged by the Barron Spotlighters Friday through Sunday at the Barron Area Community Center. The Phipps Children's Theater will present Peter Pan Friday through Sunday at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The show will continue weekends through February 26th. Love poems for St. Valentine's Day will be read Saturday by members of the Northern Lakes Theater Guild at the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts in Amory. The River Falls Community Theater will present an evening of one-act comedies Friday and Saturday, and the following Friday and Saturday at Junior's Bar and Restaurant in River Falls. The Old Gem Theater of New Richmond will present Little Red Riding Hood for student audiences weekdays through February 24th. Theater in the Woods in Shell Lake will hold auditions for Death by Design from 9 a.m. to noon Saturday and from 1 to 3 p.m. Sunday at the Erica Quam Memorial Theater. Production dates will be May 4th through the 7th and the 11th through the 14th. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild has announced auditions for The Drowsy Chaperone for 7 p.m. Monday and Tuesday, February 27th and 28th, at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
How often have we heard the term fake news lately? A lot, and often in an accusatory term from our current administration in Washington, but it does exist in an everyday sense, and it appears we're fairly susceptible to believing much of it. Well, given its phenomenal status, UW River Falls is discussing it tonight. That's if you're listening on Thursday at 7 o'clock in the North Hall Auditorium. We have 66.6% of the faculty panel that will lead the conversation. Neil Krause, professor in and chair of the Political Science Department and International Studies Program, along with Andres Strominis, an associate professor of journalism. Welcome to Spectrum West. It must be a uniquely interesting and stimulating time to be involved in both your disciplines, political science and journalism. We're talking about fake news. First, there needs to be, I think, agreement that fake news exists. There is obviously a consensus that it does. Yes?
This is Andres. Yeah, it exists, certainly. I guess the thing that I want to point out is that it's really nothing new. We simply have a new term for something that has been around for decades, if not centuries. And whether we're talking about people who basically are pranksters and simply want to have some fun at the expense of news reporters or the media or society at large, or we're talking about people who are looking to make a quick buck, you know, who want to create some sort of hoax. That's one of the characteristics of the so-called fake news that we're seeing now. Or we're talking about people who are using media as a way to spread propaganda, which we're also seeing now.
Is it safe or accurate to say it exists in far greater scope than ever before?
This is Neil. I'll just chime in quick. I mean, I think that obviously it's a lot easier to spread fake news today than as recently as, you know, 10, 15 years ago. So I think Andres makes a good point that this type of thing has been around for a very long time. But obviously you can reach, you know, an infinite number of people very, very quickly with the Internet. So I think that's what we're seeing is a change in just the magnitude of the, you know, the amount of fake news and how many people are reading it or consuming it on a regular basis.
There always have been inaccuracies in news. A lot of what I've been reading has to do with making sure that we differentiate between fake news and inaccurate news, one being malicious and the others simply being a mistake.
Correct. This is, I think, a point that I think we all as a society need to agree on, that, you know, what exactly do we mean by the term fake news? I think there are certain, you know, commentators, certain political leaders who have been using the term fake news simply as a means to point out inaccuracies. And I think that's, you know, the inaccuracy, of course, is a bad thing. It shouldn't happen. But I think to use the term fake news to be synonymous with a journalist made a mistake in a story, that is incorrect. Inaccuracies can be corrected. The journalist who is responsible for inaccuracy, if they're a principled professional, they will, in fact, do everything that they can to correct that. The sort of fake news that we really are talking about here, which is, as you said, malicious and it's a lie, there's no attempt to sugarcoat that, to make that into something that it's not. It's fake news, but it's not the same as an inaccuracy.
Is it that we are just more gullible, or is it that we are being fed way too much information, or why does this seem like it is an explosion whereby you are contending that it may not be that?
Neil, do you want to take that?
I'm not so sure that we're more gullible than in the past. I think one of the things that is happening is you have some of our leaders, including, of course, the president, continually beating this drum about, you know, this is fake news, that is fake news. That's brand new. I mean, that is not something that we have had before. By the way, he's certainly not the first person to criticize the press. That's just sort of the culmination of a decades-long effort to kind of discredit the media. The effort has been there for a long, long time to sort of undermine what the press does, what the major media does. But now you have, you know, people at the highest levels sort of ratcheting up even further. And I think that is sort of just adding gas to a fire that's been brewing for quite a long time. I'm not so sure that there's a new sort of sense of gullibility. I think also in the partisan atmosphere that we live in, I think just sort of adds to that, adds fuel to that fire as well.
Yeah, maybe gullible isn't the right word. A lot of what I read had to do with where the information we're getting is coming from. We used to get it a lot from experts or supposed experts within the media. Now we're getting a lot of information from our peers. You know, friends, quote unquote, on Facebook are sending us things. And because those people are familiar to us, we are accepting what it is they're telling us and maybe even worse, passing it on. That seems to be part of the phenomenon.
Correct. I mean, that, I think that's the phenomenon of social media in this case. And as you mentioned, we used to get our news from experts. We still do. I think the one thing that's changed in the dynamic is that people are getting their news not through filtered sources, not through established news organizations that would have some credibility, where there's an editorial process in place to vet news. It is coming directly to them through social media. So what we're seeing is particularly those, I think, who are in the business of creating hoaxes to make money or in the business of spreading propaganda, they can use social media to go directly to users. And for exactly the reason that you mentioned, you know, that somebody posts something to Facebook, somebody sees it and says, that looks interesting. It may or may not be true, but it looks interesting. So I'll like it, I'll share it, and all of a sudden you have something spreading fairly quickly across Facebook. The question that what the jury is still out on is whether or not there actually is an impact. Does it make a difference in terms of people's comprehension of what's going on and in their decisions as far as what policies to support or which political candidates to support?
And it also seems as if there's a movement to, on the parts of some people, discredit the so-called experts. And thus, people rank and file don't necessarily trust the, again, so-called experts.
I think that you know, is definitely the case. We see kind of a movement, again, for, I think, quite a while, trying to discredit the press, to discredit sort of expertise in general. And that's worked. I mean, if you look at, you know, who people trust, and now we're to the point where, you know, even the best fact checkers, the assumption, at least among some, is that, well, they have an agenda too, so we can't trust them.
Yeah.
And so it's really created this political situation where, you know, the facts are kind of up for debate all the time, at least in the minds of many voters. And I think that's a huge problem for democracy, it seems to me.
If someone is sitting in front of you or has written something that you're reading, you want to know what side they're on. The partisanship has played a big role in our skepticism of what we're being fed.
Definitely, and I think by every measure, partisanship has increased. I mean, I'd just like to point out, I think, yeah, obviously, skepticism is a good thing. We we don't want a society of people that simply go along with what they're told all the time. We want people thinking and reflecting on information and so forth. But at the same time, I think we have to also, you know, encourage people to say, you know, I'm not an expert on this area of science or on this other area of something related to technology or whatever it is, and therefore I'm going to defer to people who are experts here to tell me what is going on. I might not like what that is, but I am not qualified because I don't have the expertise to arrive at an informed view in the absence of, you know, what the experts tell us. I think that's also a part of being an educated person, is to sort of just acknowledge that hey, there's a lot of stuff I don't know about, and we need experts in a society and in a democracy to help us. Admittedly, they're going to disagree with one another oftentimes, but at least to acknowledge their role rather than to discount them.
That's the voice of Neil Krause. He's a professor and chair at the Political Science Department and International Studies Program at UW River Falls. Also on the phone with us is Andres Strominis, Associate Professor of Journalism, also at UW River Falls. They, along with Grace Coggio, will be chairing a panel of discussion at UWRF, The Effect of Fake News on Democracy. It's happening this Thursday, the 16th, 7 p.m., North Hall Auditorium. Neil, back to you quickly. Let's talk about your area of discipline, the very term political science. A portion of the science part of it says to me experimentation. And man, do we ever seem to be experimenting in politics nowadays.
That's for sure. Political science is kind of an unusual term because, as I often tell my students, we really can't, you know, do what the natural scientists do. We can't go into a lab and control the various variables and then focus on one thing. But, you know, certainly the current political debate, the recent election, and everything that has gone along with it just provides almost like a new paradigm in terms of how to evaluate all kinds of things in terms of citizens' relationship to their governments and people's attitudes about institutions and, at the, you know, the whole notion of information and media and news like we're talking about today.
And Andres, as a teacher, mentor of journalism, there is a specific category called online journalism. Other than in mechanics, does online journalism differ from the journalism that's been taught for generations, or is it basically the same thing?
Well, yes and no. I think at its heart, the basic principles of how we gather information, how we vet information, that has not changed. I rant and rail with my students very often about getting off their butts and going out and doing journalism by actually talking with people face to face and not just Googling information and emailing sources. It's, I think, still the bread and butter of journalism, talking with people and getting information firsthand. I think, and this is certainly nothing that's brand new, online journalism has the ability to, I think, provide the consumer of news a much broader menu of information. So you can prepare a news story and publish it online, but you can also provide the news consumer with original documents, with multimedia, so they can explore information through basically various platforms and through various sources themselves. So, you know, if you're covering a court case, for example, it's one thing to write a story about what's happening in court. It's another thing to add to that court story original documents, a criminal complaint, transcripts, and things like that, so the news consumer can do their own exploration. Whether the consumer actually does that, of course, is open to question. But I think there are both, you know, there are new ways of telling stories, new ways of exploring information that the digital environment provides. But, you know, at its soul, it's still bread and butter journalism, bread and butter reporting.
I was reading an article from Forbes magazine in which the quote sits, "Fake news will be an historical point of reference for a society that needed an important conversation about journalism, fact, social media, and critical analysis." They are contending that all of this controversy is good. It's good that it's happening. For one reason, journalism, they say, is reinvigorated. The good stuff will be worth reading and paying for. So you have to think that print journalists are happy that all of this is going on because they're saying, well, hey, you could come back to where we are, where we fact check, where a lot of this stuff didn't seem to be going on in the past. They like the fact that Facebook and Google, the two main sources, will be more careful, enlisting more oversight and responsibility. So the end quote to that is society will be better off after it passes through this difficult period. You guys agree with that?
It's a very hopeful statement. I hope it's true. I think we've seen statements like that in the past, certainly in American political and American media history. You can rewind the tape to the post-World War II period and see similar discussions about the failures of journalism and the failures of power and the need to re-gear and reinvigorate journalism. So let's hope that is in fact the case. Yeah, we're seeing, in the short term, various news operations that are in fact getting some financial help. Actually, it's kind of ironic that, to a certain extent, it hasn't really come from the news organizations themselves doing it. It comes from John Oliver promoting the idea of subscribing to a newspaper or supporting an online site like Politico. So, perhaps it's in the short term it's going to pay off. If it does pay off in the long term, that's even better.
What's the teaching moment to the young people who are sitting facing you at UW River Falls? Is it just perspective, or what do you want people to understand going forward after they leave your class?
I think just getting students to consider sources carefully and think very critically about, where they're getting information. I'm always reminded of the old expression, I saw it on TV, as if that necessarily made something true. And today you can almost say, well, I saw it online. We might laugh about that, but I think to the extent that we can encourage not just students but everyone, hey, wait a minute, what is that source? What is that? Where's that article from? then things hopefully would improve. And maybe, as Andres said, you know, things could improve in terms of the flow of information and our political debate and so forth.
Another quote that's been around a long time, don't believe everything you read. It must be a great time to be a fact checker. What a line to go into.
Yeah, I guess we don't have enough of those as well. That's an issue, too. You know, one of the things that again, I rat and rail with my students about is, you know, always doing original reporting, going out and finding your own information, double-checking what people tell you. And this echoes what Neil just said as well, you know, the idea of checking your sources. I guess the thing that I abhor the most is what I call lazy journalism. You know, if you simply take somebody's, you know, information that you found online and reproduce it, then you're not doing journalism. You're doing a copy-paste. That's one of the reasons that we've seen a lot of the so-called fake news spread so quickly. You know, somebody sees something and says, well, that can't be true, but what the heck, I'll pass it on just to see, you know, what kind of traction it gets. So, you know, teaching my students to avoid lazy journalism, to actually do their reporting the way they should, to stick to those primary values of journalism is the message I take into class.
I think Superman had it right. Truth, justice, and the American way.
Yeah.
This conversation is fascinating. It could go on for a long time, but you guys are going to continue it on Thursday. It's going to be real enlightening. And thanks for taking time with us here on Spectrum West. I appreciate it. Neil Krause and Andres Strominas. Thanks again.
Thank you.
And if you're listening to the Thursday edition of Spectrum West, the important discussion is tonight, 7 o'clock, North Hall Auditorium, UW River Falls. If you're part of the Friday audience, you have an idea of what's being considered, and you can follow the debate in a broader scale. Spectrum Memo, viola players from all over Wisconsin and Minnesota will come to the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire for the second annual Viola Jamboree. That's Saturday. 12 middle schools, 20 high schools, 4 universities. And they hope to see you at the 4:30 p.m. concert in Schofield Auditorium at the end of the day. That should be fun. Join the Flambeau Area Fiber Artists at the UCC Congregational Church in Ladysmith Saturday from 10 to 3 for a day of sharing their enthusiasm for fiber arts. The Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra presents a special concert Saturday featuring female vocalist Mel Flannery, a Wisconsin product, coming home from New York, 7:30 at the State Theater. Everybody gets a gift after the show, by the way. Well, Allison unscrambles the words and promotes us legibly. Thank you. Debbie mentors and arranges both people and events. Gracias. And Dean, he simply rules the roost without ruffling many feathers, which isn't easy. Much obliged. We'll do this again next week. Thanks. I'm Al Ross. Till then.